This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 135. Just chill out, Kathy. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Charlene Schmidt. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a theatrical run for Shatner's World, Leonard Nimoy and the Boston Pops, QMX's salvaging of the Voyager comm badge, and Susan Gibney, the Almost Janeway. Then in the feature, we're joined by Philip Gilfus and Daniel Prue to discuss the Voyager episode, Scientific Method. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Char. It's great to have you back with me on the Ready Room. Glad I could pull you in from the Delta Quadrant today. I almost didn't get you here because apparently there's a big snowstorm taking place here as we launch into April between the Delta and the Alpha Quadrants.
Yes, and of course it's just going to hit right smack here in Fargo like it always does. And the thing is we had a beautiful day today. Tomorrow, blizzard. That really is a description on the weather forecast. It's spring.
I was thinking that you are probably rethinking this decision to live in North Dakota, because here right now, I'm looking out the window, it's beautiful, it's sunny, the cherry blossoms are in full bloom, and you're thinking that you may be off work tomorrow because you won't be able to get there.
I would love to see a snow day keep me from going to work tomorrow, although I have a feeling I'll have to go anyway in the snow. And yes, I've rethought many times about the decision to move here, but the weather aside, everything else is pretty good, so that's kind of what keeps us going.
Well, Char, another place that gets a lot of snow in the winter, as I know, because I have clients there, is Minneapolis. And you went to Minneapolis, I think, was a year ago? To see Shatner's World. Whenever Shatner's World took place in Minneapolis, you were there. And our first news story today is about Shatner's World. And Shatner's World is going to be coming to theaters on April 24th. It's going to be shown in 630 theaters. And when I first saw the story, I got excited. And I'm still a little bit excited because although I can't go to those theaters since I'm in Japan, the fact that it's going to be on film makes me think that maybe, just maybe, there will be a Blu-ray release or they'll put it on Netflix or something and I'll finally get to see it. But tell us about it because you got to see it in person.
I did. It was 2 years ago, actually, in Minneapolis, and I saw it live there. And essentially, kind of the big takeaway from it is it's like Shatner invites you to his house and he's going through his scrapbook of life. And the things that he considers important to him, the things that he experienced. And, you know, the guy has done so many things. He's 83 years old now. He has done so much with his life, and not just with acting either. He talks a lot about his horses and his charity work, things of that nature as well. That's a lot to put into one show. And so you don't get everything in there. And he tries, but he just... Yeah, like, for instance, I remember Star Trek didn't even get a mention until maybe halfway through the show. But that said, it actually was kind of refreshing as a Trek fan to learn other things about Shatner's career that right. I might have not otherwise known. And yes, he does acknowledge Star Trek, and that's good, too. But you really do kind of get to see who the guy really is at his core.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing about Shatner is that a lot of Star Trek fans, well, not just Star Trek fans, but general public, because Captain Kirk is so well known, that's the very first thing that you think of. And, you know, there are actors who are defined by their roles, both on Star Trek and elsewhere, where that's really the only major role that they ever did, or it's by far the one that they're best known for. But William Shatner, I mean, he was known before Star Trek. Of course, Star Trek propelled him to other things, and he's known for so many things that it doesn't surprise me that Star Trek would just be something that's mentioned in the middle. I mean, he obviously embraces his role in Star Trek and is proud of the work and knows how important it is to the Shatner mythos that the world knows yes. and loves, but certainly it's not exclusively what defines him. Now, you mentioned he talked about his horses and his charity work, and while that's all very important, it doesn't necessarily sound like stuff that would be entertaining on a Broadway show, but yet this is William Shatner we're talking about. So even that, I have to imagine, is really engaging and entertaining.
Yeah, actually it is when you're in that moment. There is a section mm-hmm. where he's talking about the death of one of his horses, and you would think this is an awful thing to want to discuss to energize yeah. people and make the show lively. And yes, it is a very, I don't want to say it's a down part of the show. It's very introspective. It's very thoughtful. And it's very thought-provoking.
It's engaging, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's what it is. So it might not be the funniest part of the show, but it definitely shows a different side to him. You're going to get a little mm-hmm. bit of a lot of things about William Shatner in this show. And I'm very sad, actually, even though I did get to see this live, I would love to see it again in the theater. And of course, closest place, Minneapolis. It's not coming to Fargo. And I'm feeling like, well, I would go to the show again if I could see it live, but I'm not going to go to the theater. I'm not going to go yeah. all that way just for the theater.
Well, I'm hoping to see it on, like I said, Netflix. Maybe they'll do a Blu-ray release mm-hmm. of it that I can get. I know some of the stories, and even though I haven't seen this show, the reason that I say that I know this stuff is engaging, even if he's talking about the death of his horse, is because I've read his book, Shatner Rules, which came out, I guess it's been 2 years ago as well. And it's, you know, written by him and it's narrated by him. And he tells these stories about how he got where he is today and about all the little things that have happened in his life. And it's you feel like you're sitting down with him for a drink and he's just mm-hmm. talking to you. And he's so open and candid. And it's really, really fascinating. So,
yeah, that's how this show is. Yeah, it's very intimate.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone, if you didn't get to see this on the stage, check it out in one of these theaters. You can get tickets through Fathom Events at fathomevents.com. And in addition to the two-hour show, there will also be an exclusive welcome from Shatner. Now, I assume that this is recorded and you're going to see it on the screen. I don't think Shatner's actually going to be at all 630 theaters to personally yeah. shake your hand and welcome you.
As awesome as the guy is, I mean, he's the Priceline negotiator. He was TJ Hooker. He can do a lot of stuff, but even he, I think, is limited by being in one place at one time. At least
that's
five.
Right. He is not an Organian. He cannot project himself into multiple locations at once.
No, you can't even barrel roll your way into being in 640 or 630 places at one time.
It'd have to be one long, continuous barrel roll that just took you through each place.
Like, you'd have to just, you know, kind of turn, then pow, and then turn, pow, and keep it going 630 times. That's a lot of energy. And he is 83 now. That's unrealistic.
I don't even know how that's possible, Char. I think that violates the laws of physics.
It cannot change the laws of physics.
Well, let's go on to the next story. And this is about Leonard Nimoy. And I should mention, we have stories about William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy here. And they both celebrated their birthdays about a week ago as we're recording this.
Right.
Both turning 83. And it's amazing. I'm so happy that they're both still doing so well and that they're so active in things. Now, Leonard Nimoy is not going to be welcoming everyone to theaters. He is actually going to be together with the Boston Pops to host Out of This World on May 23rd and 24th at Symphony Hall in downtown Boston.
This sounds pretty exciting. If I were anywhere near Boston, I would love to see this, because Leonard Nimoy does not do public appearances very often anymore. This is a rare chance to see him.
Yeah, I wish I were there too. Now, I know Michael Fisher, who our listeners know is a recurring guest, lives in Boston, and I hope he's going to go over there. Maybe he can even give us a report from,
that'd be great,
from the event. That would be pretty awesome. But you know, as listeners, as many listeners know, longtime listeners know anyway, I actually am a musician. I'm classically trained. I did play professionally for 7 years in a symphony orchestra. And this is the kind of thing that's so much fun to do as a musician. I did one, I don't know if listeners will know who William Warfield is, but I can remember performing Aaron Copland's Lincoln Portrait and actually having William Warfield there to do the narration, which was just an amazing experience. So anytime that as a musician, you know, you can bring someone in like this as well to do something with you, it's a lot of fun for you as a performer and of course for the audience. And they're going to be performing some great pieces here, which most people know from science fiction movies, or maybe know because they're some of the most popular, the most widely used pieces of classical music. And these are going to include, and tell me, Char, which is your favorite from here?
Okay.
They're going to be doing the Planets, Gustav Holst's The Planets, which will be performed alongside a NASA film. They're going to be doing the theme from Star Trek, which it doesn't say in the press release which one it is. I'm guessing it might be the original series, maybe the Menagerie Suite. They're going to be doing Richard Strauss's also Sprach Zarathustra, which most people know as the theme from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And then some of John Williams's fantastic music, because John Williams is the laureate conductor of the Boston Pops, music from Star Wars, E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Which of these are your favorite compositions, Char?
Well, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say I wasn't excited for Star Trek. Yeah, I would totally be looking forward to that if I had tickets and I were going to this. But I'm also pretty interested in The Planets. That's also going to have this film alongside it. I think that's going to be beautiful. And even if Leonard Nimoy wasn't going to be at this show, I might even go for that, because that sounds pretty cool. But how about you?
Oh, you know, well, The Planets is my favorite of all of these. The Planets is such a great composition. Most people know Mars and Jupiter. Those are the two movements that are most widely used. But there's some beautiful stuff in there as well, with Neptune. And Mercury is fun as well. So lots of great stuff in there. And But I love John Williams' stuff as well. The stuff he did for Close Encounters of the Third Kind is really beautiful composition.
That's true. Also. Yeah, that is good music. Yeah. It's good all around, really. There's nothing weak here at all.
No. You get good music in science fiction.
Yeah.
Whether it's a classical or it's stuff composed by composers for the films themselves. So Leonard Nimoy is going to be doing onstage commentary during this. And I highly recommend, if you are anywhere within driving distance of Boston and you can get over there on May 23rd or 24th, definitely this is something that you won't want to miss. And you can pick up tickets through the Boston Symphony Orchestra at bso.org. So go check that out and see what's available. All right, Char, it's time to move into the Voyager section of our news.
Yay!
Today. This is a Voyager-ready room. I've got two stories here that I'm really anxious to hear your thoughts on. Tell us what the first one is.
Now, this first thing I am really excited about, and I really want to get this, actually. It is a Voyager communicator badge, and it is produced by QMX, which has been doing some phenomenal Star Trek stuff recently. And they actually they made these out of the original mold that was used for the actual communicators used on the show. So that's pretty freaking cool. And, you know, I'm pretty surprised that the molds have held up all this time. And they apparently did okay enough. They said they were a little brittle, but they were able to make enough of the replicas to produce these. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is interesting how they make them. And when you think about not just how QMX makes these types of things, but how they were made for the show itself, like we kind of take for granted when we're watching the show that they have all these props and we don't necessarily think about how they produce them or how they mass produce them because they need to have a certain number for the show and what the build quality is like. For example, I remember thinking when TNG went to the big screen for Generations, and of course when the Blu-rays were being produced as well, like how are the little communicator badges going to hold up in HD mm-hmm. when you can finally see them more like you were actually there in person? Because it was so easy on standard definition television to kind of mask that type of stuff. And then you see that, wow, they're so well produced and they look so beautiful. And they talk about how brittle the molds were, and they were silicon molds, and this 2014 right now, so it's been more than 20 years since those yeah. molds were made. And it's actually kind of amazing to me that they held up well enough over the course of 20 years that they could go back and actually use them again to produce something like this.
Yeah, that's a very long life for a mold. But apparently they did get enough. And I actually went to their website today. You can buy them. They are $19.95 a piece, which I think is a completely reasonable price for something that
oh, yeah.
is not only Absolutely. A genuine like a replica, but it's also hand-painted. So that's pretty mm-hmm. freaking cool. So I'm very excited about this. I just love the fact that they went through this big process and tried to make it as genuine as possible. It doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah, it's really cool. So they are still available. You can still get them for $20.
Yeah, for the That's time nice. Being. I don't know how long they intend on having these available. Do you?
I don't know, but I think they were only able to make a limited number of them because, again, the mold, they talked about it. Actually, John Eblen, who is the FX Cinema Arts Division head at QMX, it was his job to restore them and get them ready for reproduction. And he talked about how they were old, but they were in good shape. And that QMX had acquired those molds from the prop masters. And he said it was great to have them in the shop, but we had to glue them back together a few times. But in the end, we were able to send cast masters to our manufacturer to produce the metal version. So they were able to get enough casts out of them to actually make the metal version. And so I don't know how many they've actually produced, but you know, typically with these things, they are limited. So I don't think you'll be able to get them indefinitely. But $20 is a fantastic price. I think I paid that much back in the 90s for just a you know, a cheap version that was made as a little pin, you know, just to like, right. you know, stick on your jacket.
I remember those.
Of a TNG, like an embossed metal, you know, TNG badge. So mm-hmm.
Didn't if you could press it and then it would make the little clicky sound. Did it do that? I don't remember.
They made those, but that's not what I had, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is about as authentic as it gets.
Yeah, it is as authentic as it gets. And these were, of course, these were used on DS9 later on and in the TNG films, but it was Voyager who debuted the little rectangular back on the comm badges. So great to see those. So go check those out. And we have one more Voyager story today, Char. What is this one about?
This one's pretty interesting. StarTrek.com interviewed Susan Gibney, who they label as the almost Janeway, but I know her better as Dr. Leah Brahms on TNG. She also played, you might know her better as Commander Erica Benteen on DS9. And in the interview, it's kind of funny. Gibney says that was the consolation prize for not getting right. the role of Janeway, because we, of course, know who ultimately won the role. But she was in the running. And she says in the interview that she was called back after Bujold dropped out, because after about a day and a half, Bujold said, no, I can't do this. They called Gibney back, along with a couple of others, back to L.A. And so she apparently got close to getting the role. And this is kind of a theme for her. This isn't the first time it's happened for her in Star Trek. She has auditioned for a lot of roles, in fact, in Star Trek. I mean, it's a list. I'll just read them to you. She auditioned for Troi, Yar, Janeway, Seven of Nine, and the Borg Queen in First Contact, and did not get any of them.
Right. And the reason she didn't get them is kind of interesting, as she describes it in the interview anyway. And I actually believe what she's saying. There's this tug of war, because we hear it with even on the Enterprise Blu-rays. You know, Rick Berman talks about this too, that there's this tug of war between the producers and the studio sometimes about who's going to be cast in a role. And it seemed she felt that Rick Berman really wanted her in some of these roles, particularly Janeway and also the Borg Queen. And she said that Jonathan Frakes actually called her and said, "You're going to be the Borg Queen," and then called her back the next day and said, "I'm sorry, I'm really, really sorry, but you're not going to be the Borg Queen after all." Yeah. And it seemed like a case where maybe Frakes and Berman got together and thought, yeah, you know, Susan would be great as the Borg Queen. And then the studio mm-hmm. said, no, we want to go with someone else. I think maybe they wanted to go with someone who was more known as a film star, as a film actress. And so they went with maybe Alice Krieger, who did a phenomenal job as the Borg Queen. But there's this tug of war, you know, that goes on sometimes, I think, there. The Troy and Yar thing, I don't know. You know, a lot of people auditioned for those early roles on TNG. And of course, it's famous that Marina Sirtis and Denise Crosby were auditioning for the opposite roles. Right. And then they got cast as Troy and Yar. Seven of Nine, you know, it was not easy, I think, to find Jeri Ryan. Just like it was not easy to find Jolene Blaylock to play T'Pol on Enterprise. It's always hard to find, and Terry Farrell for Jadzia Dax on DS9 as well. You know, she was the last character to be cast on DS9. It's hard to find actresses to play these roles, they say. And I can see where they were having a hard time finding Seven of Nine. And then they finally brought Jeri Ryan in and she got the part. So I don't think the fact that Susan Gibney didn't get any of these roles says anything about her as an actress or the quality of her auditions. It's the fact that she was there as like one of the last two or three women standing for these roles, actually, I think shows just how impressed the producers were with her.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, I know her best. You mentioned Benteen, although I still always think of her as Leah Brahms.
Yeah, I would say she's probably the more popular character in Trek fandom. And she did finally get that role. she did finally get on Star Trek. And yeah, she was apparently very well known among the creatives at Star Trek, and they really did like her, and they really did want her to be involved somehow. And yeah, like you said, the producers would probably come back, "Oh, we want somebody else," and has nothing to do with the fact that she was an amazing actress. She still is, in fact. She's still acting. She just completed work on a horror film, apparently, and she also runs something called Rogue Actor Training. It's a new studio in Rochester, New York, where she lives, and so she's still quite involved, even though she's no longer in L.A.
Right. And she said she still goes out west from time to time to do a little bit of acting, and she's planning to keep doing that. But she's really enjoying being in Rochester now with her family, and, you know, has her daughters there in school and exploring, you know, the Rogue Actor Training. I wanted to ask you, though, just a thought experiment here.
Okay.
We're so accustomed to Kate Mulgrew as Captain Janeway. Can you imagine a Susan Gibney Janeway? What do you think it would have been like?
Really tough to imagine that. I can't not think of Susan Gibney and Leah Brahms. So I have Leah Brahms as Captain Janeway, and that's not working for me. And that's not to say that she would play the role incredibly different than she did from the Brahms character. It really is hard to think that. But then I couldn't really imagine how Bujold was playing the role until I saw those wonderful tapes that came out on the DVDs that showed some of the filming that Bujold did do on the series. It's really hard to imagine the show without Kate Mulgrew, because she just made it what it was in so many ways.
Yeah, it is really, really difficult to look back at it at this point and imagine anyone else in that role. I do think the Leah Brahms thing, for me as well, would be a little bit difficult. You know, it was a little bit difficult, even with Robbie Duncan McNeil as Tom Paris because we had already mm-hmm. seen him as Cadet Locarno in the first duty on TNG. And then you have him coming in as this new character. But that was just a one-off appearance, and he wasn't in that episode that much.
Right.
I guess he was in that episode as much as Leah Brahms was in. But she had two appearances, and she said there would have been a third. There was a third planned, but she got pregnant, so that didn't work. But Leah Brahms is such an engaging character. So Locarno was just a cadet at the academy, and that was really a Wesley story. But mm-hmm. Locarno was there. But Leah Brahms, being the love interest for Geordi, was so prominent that it would have been difficult. I'm sure we would have all gotten over it after a season or so. But it would have been hard seeing her as the captain because it would have just gone straight back to Leah Brahms.
There definitely would have been an adjustment there, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But it's a really interesting two-part article over at StarTrek.com, and I love these articles that they do because I love to hear what the actors are doing today, and I love to hear behind the scenes of what went on, how they got their roles, what their experience was with the cast and crew. She talks a little bit about the differences of being on the set of TNG and being on the set of DS9. So we'll put links in the show notes to these as well, and you can go check those out over there at StarTrek.com. All right, Char, one last thing in news today, and this is about our friends over at TrekCore. Now, TrekCore is a great website that's really important for us to find out what's going on in Star Trek news. They do really fantastic behind the scenes, looking into the production of the Blu-rays, for example. They do a lot of in-depth analysis of things as well, and they have amazing image libraries also. If you go over there, they have over, I think it's over 800,000 screen stills over there. It's really quite amazing knowing how they host that. They've been around for 9 years, and they are doing a fundraiser right now. So just like we here at Trek FM need your support because it costs us money to produce these podcasts and to keep our network going, TrekCore also needs your support if you enjoy what they're doing. And they have a fundraiser going on right now.
Yeah. And they've actually done a fantastic job of keeping costs down for their website. But even so, yeah, this stuff does not come for free. So what they're looking to do is they want to raise funds for 2 years of hosting, 2 years of domain renewals, and they want to purchase an upgrade for the message board because right now the version they're using is outdated. It doesn't have any support anymore. And
that's what they have in. That's not our opinion of it. That's what they say about it themselves.
Yeah. Not their words, not ours.
their words, not ours.
And if you're interested in donating, they would prefer that you donate through PayPal. And that's a very simple, easy thing to do. If you haven't done it before, it's about as quick and painless as using a credit card. So no complication there. And if you don't want to do that, though, and you want to donate by other means, they do say, feel free to contact our webmaster and you can send a check or a money order.
Right. Yes. Check or money order. Char, when you say by other means, they don't want you to send them candy bars like you do to Tristan or anything like that.
Right.
Actual money we're talking about here.
Yes. Yeah. The paper stuff that you used to back in the day uses currency. Yes.
Right. So we'll put a link in the show notes over to that as well. But go over and check it out and, you know, help out TrekCore. Help them keep bringing all the great behind-the-scenes information to us all as fans that they do. And good luck to TrekCore. All right. Well, that's all we have in news today, Char. But before we jump into the feature where we're going to be joined by two of the cohorts from Earl Grey, Daniel Prue and Philip Gilfus, to talk about the Voyager episode Scientific Method, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. Now, Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from. They put hundreds of new titles on the site every week. It's really quite amazing. I don't know how they get this much stuff into audio format because they actually produce a number of these books themselves. A lot of great science fiction classics. For some reason, publishers, they like to take current releases, mysteries and dramas and nonfiction books and all, and they put those out in in audio format, but a lot of the great science fiction classics have never been produced very professionally in audio format. And Audible.com has actually set up a studio themselves to bring a lot of those old classics of science fiction to life. So it's amazing how much stuff they produce there.
That is.
But what we like to do every week on here is, of course, recommend a book to everyone, because as a Trek FM listener, you can get a book of your choice absolutely free just for trying Audible. And the book I want to recommend today is the one I mentioned, Sharp, when we were talking about Shatner's World. Shatner Rules, Your Key to Understanding the Shatnerverse and the World at Large. And this is a fantastic book. It's a great title. It's a fantastic book. If you haven't read it, you really, really need to.
And I haven't. So this might very well be what I do in lieu of picking up some kind of paper book, because, yeah, well, what's even better is not only is this written by William Shatner, but he narrates it as well. So, I mean, right. Who better to talk about William Shatner than William Shatner?
Exactly. And that's why when I say you need to read it, I don't mean pick up the paper book. I mean, go to Audible and get this book, because, and when we say Shatner narrates it, it's not like other books where there is someone who's reading the book to you in that sense of narrating it. It's more like Shatner is telling you the story. I mean, it is written down on a page. You can get the paper book, but you don't feel like Shatner's reading his book to you. You feel like Shatner's just telling you a story about his life.
And who doesn't want that? Right?
No one that I can think of.
Yeah, this does sound really cool. I am going to have to take a look at this.
So what is the book about? Okay, this is what the publisher synopsis says about it. And I think it's very true. Admit it. You want to be William Shatner. This collection of rules, illustrated with stories from Bill's illustrious life and career, will show you how Bill became William Shatner, larger than life and bigger than any role he ever played. Shatner Rules is your guide to becoming William Shatner, or more accurately, beautifully Shatneresque.
Wow, who wrote that synopsis?
It sounds like William Shatner maybe wrote that himself.
Admit it, you want to be William Shatner. Yeah.
Absolutely. And in this book, William Shatner gives you one really important piece of advice that's something that has kind of always been the way I've operated, and I loved hearing William Shatner echo it as being how he got where he is learning to say yes, because when you say no, you close doors. But when you say yes, you never know where that's going to lead. And he talks about that's how so many of the things that he's done in his career that we all know and love, that's how it happened. Was someone approached him about something, and maybe the first instinct was to say, no, I'm too busy, I'm not interested in that. But instead he said yes, and it led to some amazing place.
I think that's also a nice little testament on how Shatner really is a great example of someone who is not afraid to fail. Because not everything he has tried has been an instant success. And anybody who is successful does have a couple of stumbles, a couple of failures. That's where you really learn how to do it right and then really achieve the success. So that's an interesting thing that he puts out there. Learn to say yes. Okay.
It does mean that you're really busy all the time, but it also means you get to do really interesting things. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a risk.
So again, as a Trek FM listener, you can get Shatner Rules, Your Key to Understanding the Shatnerverse and the World at Large, absolutely free. And all you need to do to get this great book is to go over to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up for Audible. Give Audible a try. If at the end of the trial period you decide Audible's not for you, which I can't imagine if you're listening to this podcast, you're going to love audiobooks. But if you decide you don't want to stick with Audible, you get to keep this book absolutely free. It's yours, so nothing to lose. But by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep the Ready Room and all of our shows coming to you every week. So try it out. audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of The Ready Room and the network. Aliens performing experiments on the crew without their knowledge is nothing new for Star Trek. TNG did it to very creepy effect in Schisms, and Enterprise also did it in a somewhat different way in Observer Effect. But Voyager delivered perhaps the most entertaining lab rats in space story in the season 4 episode Scientific Method. And today we're going to talk about this episode, Tom and B'Elanna getting busy in engineering, Seven and the Doctor wearing tights together, and Janeway channeling Sisko. And to help us do that, we're joined by two members of the Earl Grey trio, Philip Gilfus and Daniel Prue. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
How's everything going today? Good to have you guys with us from the Enterprise D over here onto the USS Voyager.
Yes, this is the trademark Earl Grey decaf condition team here.
Very good. So we're going to talk about Scientific Method today. And when I asked you guys what episode you would like to do, Shar, you threw out Scientific Method, and I jumped right on that because Michael Fisher and I sort of mentioned this episode on Warp 5 2 weeks ago when we were talking about Observer Effect. And it's one of my favorite Voyager episodes. But why did you pick this one?
Well, it's one of my favorites as well. We're obviously going to go into a lot more detail, but just to blanket statement it right now, I think it's got one of the best messages and meanings of a Trek episode. We see Janeway going ballistic. And remember, the more disheveled the hair, the worse off she is. So you know right. She's in distress. Things are going to happen. And of course, there's a little bit of making out. So what's not to love?
A little bit of making out. I was hoping they weren't going to accidentally eject the warp core. A good thing Tuvok walked in when he did.
Lesson learned. Don't make out against a control panel. That's a dead giveaway.
See, I've ragged on the Elcar's system before, but the problem with making the eject the warp core button a third of the size of the panel is it's really easy to accidentally hit, you know, if you're pushing someone up against it. So.
Yeah, that is a fail.
It's a good thing that Johnny Ive did not design the Elcar system. Otherwise, the eject warp core button would actually be a small text link with no button outline at all. And it would be very difficult to hit in the event of an emergency. That's in Elcar's 7, of course. All right. Well, before we jump into the discussion here, a quick rundown of this episode for anyone listening who hasn't seen this one in a long time. Hopefully you've seen it before. This is the episode where weird things start happening to the Voyager crew. B'Elanna and Tom are acting like teenagers, pretty much, as their relationship heats up. Chakotay's hair starts falling out. Janeway is incredibly grumpy. And of course, Seven of Nine is a new crew member on the ship as well, and she's rubbing people the wrong way, and they're maybe overreacting to it a little bit. And as it turns out, it's all because some aliens who are out of phase with the crew are all over the ship. There are 56 of them, in fact, and they're poking and prodding and attaching crazy medical instruments and headgear and all sorts of things to the crew to run experiments on them, to do research that will help their own people to live better lives by solving physical or psychological ailments. But it's really putting our crew through hell, and it's becoming life-threatening as well because they're altering DNA. And eventually they have to stop these aliens, and it is thanks to Seven being on the ship now and the Doctor being a computer program that they're able to save the ship. And then as the episode goes along, of course, it has a deeper message about performing experiments on other people, on other species as well, and whether that's right or wrong. And I would say it doesn't really come down on either side, but we'll talk about that as we go along. But that's the episode. And the first thing to talk about really is the message of the episode and the theme of the episode. And I actually want to start with the theme of the episode. And Philip and Daniel, have you guys jump in here, because, of course, Brandon Braga was co-executive producer of Voyager. He didn't write this particular episode, but it's very much a Braga style. He did write Schisms on TNG. Initial thoughts watching this episode, Philip, what did you think about this one when you look back at Schisms?
Well, you know, I know the To the Journey podcast.
To the Journey!
That Shar and Tristan do are beginning their continuing series of who plotted it the best.
And that's right.
What this actually reminded me of was Lonely Among Us, the TNG episode, okay. Which was also a sort of rats in a maze episode. Mm-hmm. So I submit that, Shar, for consideration.
Okay, thanks.
But I think this is an interesting episode, and I know we'll talk about it, but one of the things I noted watching this episode is that this is a hilarious episode, yet deadly threat episode, which right. You don't usually see. I mean, it's usually deadly threat serious or Tribbles hilarious, you know, in Trek. But in this one, like, you know, people die in this episode, but it is, you know, probably one of the funniest Voyager episodes that there is. And so I think it's definitely, it can be very, it's a very haunting episode. The mystery, I mean, because I think it's like 30 minutes in until we actually find out what's happening almost, and all that. And so the build up, the reveal, the what are we going to do, and is, you know, I think this is a really good episode. I mean, this is just my general comments. I know we'll get into the details.
I looking back at Schisms, I definitely see flavors of Schisms in the episode. Obviously, it's it's a little bit different. Obviously, the setup's different because in that episode on TNG, the crew leave the ship; they're abducted, which is right. Really where the scariness and the creepiness of that episode comes from. Whereas in obviously this episode, the threat is imminent. It's already on the ship. It's never leaving. It's just a constant presence. So it's a little bit different in that respect. But I feel a lot like you can kind of see that that's kind of an evolution of that concept. Maybe in Brandon's mm-hmm. mind, maybe he wasn't aware of it or whatever. But like you can see that it's kind of like Schisms kind of leads into this episode.
I mean, the problem was Chakotay would have had that flashback to the scissors, but he never got a chance to go to the barber because all the hair fell out. So if he had gone to the Voyager ship's barber, that probably would have been the reveal.
I like that.
That's good. Yeah, it is like, now this episode, of course, wasn't written by Brandon Braga. It was written by Lisa Klink. And the story is by Sherry Klein and Harry Doc Clore, which a name that always makes me think of Back to the Future. You know, it's not. But
great Scott.
But in terms of an evolution of it, yeah, I see that. It's almost like Schisms is scientific method light, or so, because the aliens in Schisms weren't trying to really, I think they were careful not to harm the crew, right? They wanted things to remain secret. So it's just something like, it looks like you broke your arm before. Do you remember breaking your arm and the bone healed back, but it's not quite right? You know, whereas here it's like, if people die, they don't really care. It's they're full on, and the extent of it, the scene when Seven walks into the mess hall and you see everybody sitting there with these braces under their chin and that gigantic helmet vice thing on, and
yeah,
the tubes and the whole big mechanical box on the person's chest. The idea that you're walking around with this and you have no idea it's on you in the first place is really creepy.
It really is. And did anybody else have childhood flashbacks of wearing orthodontic appliances?
Right, that's what I thought of.
Because I had to wear headgear when I was 10 years old. And so when I saw this, I kind of had some flashback
like,
moments.
That's not
pleasant.
Funny what you're doing to that crewman right there.
That really was me. It was awful.
Yeah. I luckily never had to wear anything like that. However, that is the very first thing I thought of when I saw this, even the first time I saw it.
Yeah, it looks like headgear, only maybe even more painful and distracting somehow.
Well, didn't at one point Janeway literally just had spikes sticking out of her head? Like,
yes.
They were kind of like temple whiskers. Like they were just
temple whiskers.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. And I like when Seven goes in to talk to her and there are the two scientists on each side of Janeway and they're just twisting those things.
Yeah. Right. And you can just tell she is, oh, that's gotta hurt.
Yeah, it's the coffee drain. So that's why she's getting more and more miserable as they twist
it. Is that what it is?
See, I thought what had happened was that the aliens had secretly replaced her coffee with decaf. And that's why she was so irritable for the whole time.
Oh, so this was a caffeine headache. That makes a lot of sense. Because as a side note, Kate Mulgrew had quit smoking during the filming of this episode. Yeah. And, you know, if you've ever withdrawn from something, caffeine or worse, cigarettes are incredibly addictive in their withdrawal symptoms. Like the first 3 days, especially physically, are incredibly hard. And so she channeled a lot of that, those side effects and dealing with them into her performance in this episode, which is totally perfect.
You know, we'll talk about this more when we talk about Janeway being pushed to the limit. But I think it was very effective. And I actually think it came off as more natural than usual for Kate Mulgrew, the acting.
Yeah, it totally worked. So she picked a heck of a good time.
To your point, Philip, I thought that they replaced her coffee with Folger's crystals.
That's even worse than Neelix's better than coffee substitute.
Exactly. You're talking about sort of flashbacks to other episodes. I mean, when and I love how the aliens don't get a name in this episode. They're just the aliens.
They're named in the script, but not on screen. Yes.
Are they called Voldemort, and we're not allowed to say it?
Aliens who shall not be named.
They're called the Srivani in the script, but they never actually say that on the screen.
I'll assume the Q is silent. But like when the aliens were telling Janeway, like, oh, you know, a fourth of your crew will die or whatever, like, it reminded me of, and Daniel or anyone else will have to remind me, Nigellum, was that his name in Lonely Among Us?
Yeah.
It was like, Picard, you know, I'll probably only kill like a tenth of your crew. After that, y'all will be free to go. I'm like, and I love how the aliens were like, that was going to be the convincing thing. Like, oh, we'll do some tests, we'll give you the data, some will die. That'll be cool, right? I'm like, who's going to say yes to that? Like, were they think they were being persuasive there? Oh, yeah, that's fine. We're good. You do your thing.
But it's for the greater good, Gilfus. Now, come on. Think of all the diseases that they can cure and the better quality of life these people will have as a result of what they learn from these experiments.
Oh, sure.
I actually love this episode for that reason. It presents both sides of the issue. It does make a case. Because we live in this world, right? I mean, we do experiments on animals, and the thing is, with humans, they should be, at least in this day and age, consenting. But we've certainly not done that in the past, and so you see both sides of it, and I just love the way they do this. Because, like any good Star Trek episode, of course we're not told what the answer is. We just have to sit with it and decide for ourselves, and you could easily make a case for either side. Now, for me as an impressionable teenager when this show aired, it did help me pick a side. So it actually has a lot of deep personal impact for me. So it's got that nostalgic value, which I think is why I like this episode so much.
Yeah, it does make a point. It makes a strong argument. Well, I guess it's a strong argument on both sides, both Janeway's position and the position of the Srivani scientist. But it doesn't tell you, right, which one is right or which one is wrong. I mean, it's, maybe it's, like sometimes in Star Trek, maybe it's assumed that because you're a Star Trek fan, you're going to say that the Starfleet side, Federation side is right. But this one doesn't push that. This one is, it's very much, you know, it's somewhere, it's sort of DS9 in a way. It's somewhere in the middle, you know. The real answer is probably somewhere in between these two extremes.
Well, and I love the fact that it's the Starfleet crew that is the lab rats, because they essentially are considered then, therefore, like the lesser creatures, or maybe not as worthy of life, or at least worthy of being experimented on. And so I think that actually strengthens each argument, because I can totally see how, as a non-consenting person, no, of course I don't want to be a part of these experiments. Why would it possibly be acceptable to lose some of my crew in the name of the greater good? But at the same time, you know, it's the Star Trek argument of do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Is it okay if a few people are sacrificed if overall more people benefit? You know, what are a few lab rats in an animal testing experiment? What's a few bunnies that can easily be replenished in population when it comes to curing things like cancer or AIDS or any other epidemic that's hit us in recent, you know, any time really, but recent centuries, I was going to say. Then again, well, where do you draw the line? Where's the disconnect on what worthy or what life is worthy over another? Is there a disconnect? And I form my own opinion. I don't want to preach about that, but it certainly does make you think.
And as you guys were talking about it, I found it really interesting because as you're, especially when Chris mentioned the scene where Janeway's in the brig with the alien scientist, and I'm like, you know what? Almost all of TOS, but specifically Spock, would definitely land on one side of the argument, which is against the Voyager crew. He would have been like, well, kind of, you know, he would have been probably like, you know, if we're gaining more benefit out of this, you know, that philosophy of whatever it takes to get the greater benefit is where we're going to land. It's really interesting that Star Trek is kind of self-examining itself at this point. Like we've come far enough and, you know, gone, you know, at that point for 30 years-ish. And they were like, well, maybe it's not that simple. Maybe, you know, it's different now. Maybe we can look at it in a different lens. And it's just kind of interesting to see it in a different way.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. It's not that simple. Definitely.
But I think one of the challenges here, I think with the aliens, like I think back to the first episode, and I'm blanking, was it just called Phage? The first Vidian episode?
Phage, yeah.
Of Voyager. Yes. Where, you know, as horrible as the Vidians were shown, at least that brief scene at the end, you had some sympathy-ish with them. You know, you had Janeway going, you know, you have my deepest sympathies, but blah, blah, blah. And but so I thought, like, even in that small amount of time, they sort of presented the Vidian case and, you know, okay. But see, I think this one, I didn't get any sympathy for these aliens because, A, they don't even get a name. But, B, like, I just don't, you know, like, they never talk about why they're doing it. Just like, oh, for knowledge and to help with living longer lives. But, like, okay, that just sounds like a luxury class. Like, what is this, the 1% taking over? Like, I mean, what's like, I didn't have any reason to be on their side, you know, in this.
Well, since it was the humans who were being experimented on, and the aliens are essentially saying, yeah, well, if you're just a bunch of lab rats to us, I think it is a little easier to sympathize maybe with the human side. Maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Philip that the alien, see, the interesting thing about this episode is that we don't really know what's going on until it's 20 minutes when we start to get clues. That's when B'Elanna and the doctor are figuring out that there are these barcodes on the DNA and they're emitting some kind of signal. And then it's still a bit longer before we actually find out what's really going on when Seven starts roaming around the ship. And so, yes, there really isn't any time for us to develop any sort of sympathy for the aliens and what they're doing in their position. It's really just left to us to think about. It's one of those stories where, okay, these are the aliens, but what we're really thinking about here is only humans and what we do to each other or what we do to other species here on Earth. Now, I've seen this compared to the Vidians before, where people will say that the Srivani and the Vidians are similar and that they're running experiments on people and they're trying to find medical knowledge that can help their own people. However, the Vidians are a race because we get to see them multiple times, for one thing, and stories really center on them from start to finish, who you do develop sympathy for. And you can see humans in the Vidians and see, like, if we were pushed to that point, we might do the same thing that the Vidians were doing. But in this episode, yeah, you don't make that connection with these aliens.
Right. Yeah, if we'd found out that maybe they were trying to find a cure for some disease that was wiping them out, like the Vidians, maybe we would feel a little more sympathy toward them.
Because this seems random, like, right? It's like, you know, we can cure all kinds of stuff with this information.
It's more like general research. Like, yeah. Let's see what happens when we do this to this person.
Right.
You know, okay, so I kind of came at this from a little bit of a different perspective than it sounds like you guys did. Whereas, like, it seems like in the way that you're looking at it, and maybe you know, I'm just seeing it in a different light, but you guys seem to be looking at it as like, this is how we as humans interact with other species and experiment on them. I actually kind of saw this as a parallel to the other previous Voyager episode, I believe, where it was a Nazi parallel, kind of like how we treat each other. Like, mm-hmm. what if I gain immense scientific knowledge from the torture and mistreatment of other of my own kind? Where it's like, I the reason I think they were such a blank slate is like, is because what if we gained knowledge from causing suffering to other sentient human beings, essentially? And I think that's maybe a different question, certainly, but maybe a tougher question. But the way I would look at it was like, so this woman who's in the brig is not supposed to represent animals that we test shampoo on, but like, what if we could get the cure for cancer by irradiating right. other human beings? Like, what yeah. would that be ethically sound? Would it be okay to torture or mistreat 300 people if it would mm-hmm. save 1,000 people?
I think the yeah. issue is consent. Are these sure. willing yes. participants, or are these people who are captured and subjected against their will?
Yeah, there's a case here in North Carolina, and I'm blanking on what disease it was, but it was during the 30s or 40s. A lot of African Americans were exposed to some certain disease.
It was syphilis.
Yeah, maybe that was it.
I think so, because we had the same thing happen in Alabama. I think it was Tuskegee, actually. But yeah,
right. And so, like, just now, or in the past few years, like 2 to 3 years, our state legislature is trying to like put together a fund and try to, you know, which you never can, trying to compensate, you know, these folks who had to go through these, you know, non-consent experiments. And so that's sort of at least the as contemporary an example as I can think of.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you, Daniel, actually, because I saw that as well as the animal thing and also what you mentioned, Philip. So there are really three things that I saw here, and it all happens in that conversation between Janeway and the scientist. My thought process anyway, where the first thing I think of is the Nazi parallel, you know, an actual experimentation on prisoners. And then the thing you're talking about, Philip, because I was remembering it may be a different case, but it was very, very similar that we had in Alabama back in that time as well with infecting. And it was mostly African Americans who were unknowingly exposed to, I'm pretty sure it was syphilis. And then I also, in that conversation, jumped to the animal testing as well. Not just testing chemicals like in shampoos and things, but actually medical research as well. So I think this episode tries to cover all those bases, I think, and it does try to do it very quickly at the end. But this is a case where, you know, I often complain about Voyager episodes taking too long to get to the point. So it's like you get 20 or 25 minutes into an episode before they ever actually anything happens. You know, it's just so much build up and technobabble. But this is an episode where I think that the build up was great, and the fact that we don't really get any clues until 20 minutes in, and then it's half an hour before we find out really who's responsible, is really, really effective. The buildup was really effective because you're wondering, like, what the hell is going on? And you get those little moments where you see the sort of X-ray muscular scan effect, and that's cool, and it lets you know that something weird is going on. But I'm thinking back to the first time I saw it, I don't think that I ever really... I wasn't thinking like, oh, there are aliens on the ship running experiments on people at first. And so when that reveal came, it was really creepy and really effective.
I totally agree. That is a big criticism of a lot of Voyager, is there's not enough time to explore the real issue at hand. But I feel like the pacing of this one really is spot on, because you want the mystery, you do want the buildup, and then there is just enough time left to make us think about what this episode is really saying without giving us an answer. It's just enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's an interesting setup because, and I'm just making these numbers off the top of my head, like 80% hilarious episode, but then it has like, and I don't know, Shari, I'm sure you can think of a better example, but to me this is probably like the best 7 minutes ending Voyager episode ever. Like, you can just watch that last 7 minutes or 8 minutes, like when that crew member dies, and like that is just like the best ending of any Voyager episode ever, in my opinion. I mean, maybe there's a better one, but like, it's just everything is compact right in that time. It's like,
yeah,
you get it, you get the message, you get Janeway being Janeway, and it's pretty awesome.
It's good action. But I would definitely disagree, actually. I think you need to know why Janeway is essentially flipping her lid at the end of this episode and why she's willing to kill everyone, essentially, if this thing doesn't work. I mean, she really is putting everybody at risk here. One thing I want to actually know from everybody here is, do you think she went too far or did she have to go this far?
Why?
Daniel, you're kind of shaking your head.
Say it,
the more I watch, you know, I want to be very diplomatic about this, but the more I watch Voyager,
just say it.
the more I see of Janeway, because I've watched all of Voyager before, but the more I rewatch it, I'm like, I don't know that this woman maybe should be in charge. I don't know. Like, she's just, yes, she seems a bit erratic,
Daniel,
and crazy. And like, and she's like, she tells the woman that comes on the bridge, and she's like, well, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to drive into these stars. It's going to be great. Like, it's like, I'm just like, calm down. Like, I would rather be experimented on than die. Please don't fly into the sun.
You know, that point right there, Daniel, it's funny that I have the same impression of Janeway as well, by the way. But the moment that I always think of as the example of how erratic Janeway is in this episode when she's going to fly into these binary pulsars and destroy the ship. And even when I don't remember which episode it came from, it's just that's the moment I remember. And yeah, I think it's hard to say if she went too far or not in this episode because she's under stress that's being inflicted on her by these aliens. So it's not completely her. Like, I don't really feel like Janeway would go to this extreme on her own.
I do think
she went a little bit overboard here. Now, when you watch this the first time, before you know what's actually happening to her, you really do feel like, what's wrong with you, Kathy? Okay, so Tom and Milana like to make out in engineering. Big deal. You know, they're adults. And when she whips the finger out at them, she's like, you are under orders to use better judgment. I'm like, just chill out, Kathy.
Right, but they're playing around with her brain chemicals.
Right.
And she has basically not slept in 4 days. I mean, how would you feel? You'd probably be a little bit on edge, too, and I actually take the stance now that Janeway did what she had to do by flying the ship into the pulsars. Initially, when I first saw it, I thought, dang, girl, take it down a notch. But you know what? She was not going to put up with that shit anymore. And this was how she proved it.
Well, but really,
if she would have withdrawn, then the scientists would have not taken her seriously. They would have known that she was game for more, but she was not. This was over.
In space, all warriors are cold ones.
That's right.
But I don't know that I can agree that this was what she had to do. I mean, it's a big leap from having the crew turn on the aliens and take the ship back and maybe a few of the crew members die in the process versus flying your starship into binary pulsars. It's just...
I don't know. I think she was trying to make an outlandish station or an outlandish statement.
Oh well, she
you
was want to
see the result of your experiment?
That.
Here's the result of your experiment.
Well, right.
I'll give you your result.
That's right.
I think that's the point that Janeway may be the only character that's willing to prove a point with the death of her ship and all of her crewmates, and, you know, in order to do that. And it's just like, relax. Like, there's got to be another way around
there's
it.
Got to be another way. Yeah.
Maybe bluff it.
What had happened was that Janeway had just binged on House of Cards, and she remembered Frank's advice, if you don't like the pieces on the board, just flip the board over. And that's really
maybe
what she did. But see, I have to defend Janeway and say, look, there were echoes of Kirk here who would self-destruct his ship at the drop of a hat with any alien threat. We are going to take
Amen,
over
sir.
Your self-destruct. 00 code. Like, well, really? Can we wait? Are we going to... And so, I
zero,
mean,
zero. Destruct. Exactly. Zero.
And so, like,
well, I have to say, Philip, that you know, self-destructing your ship is also one of the Picard maneuvers, along with turning around and running away.
And it is a Janeway maneuver, too.
Yes.
She does it several times, especially early on.
It's great drama, though, right? You're going to blow up the ship.
Well, sure, exactly. That's why they do it. Yeah.
I mean, would you rather the computer blow up the ship or the helmsman do it? It's just, you know.
I don't know. At the end, I didn't think it was great drama. At the end, I was just like, this seems like a really easy solution to the problem of how do we get rid of invisible aliens? And I'm like, come on, like, you're going to, I don't know. Like, it just, and Tuvok's like, 20-1. And she's like, I'll take those odds. And it's just like, really? Like, are you kidding me?
Janeway would. Yeah.
Well, I think it wasn't an easy solution. It was easy that they survived. Like, they're.
Yeah.
Well, of course. Of course they're going to survive. Right. They're only in season 4 at this point.
Well, remember that they survived this. Everything is okay. But earlier in the episode, Janeway thought that maybe flying too close to a star caused Chakotay to age rapidly.
This is true, right? And then suddenly, that's not an issue. There is that. That is a flaw of this episode.
What if everyone on the bridge became really, really old suddenly?
Could you just imagine all these old people whining about their health ailments together, trying to one-up one another?
Okay, let's go into that. Let's talk about that. The one of the great humor moments in the episode are the grumpy old men, which was just like the Monty Python sketch where they're trying to one-up each other about how hard their lives are.
Right.
Now, Char, you said in the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
That this would make a great sitcom, Chakotay and Neelix. And I would love to watch that show.
I think this really should have been a backdoor pilot for some sort of a sitcom for H. Chakotay and Neelix to just constantly try to one-up each other with how miserable they are. I think it would have been fantastic. I would have watched it.
It reminds me of when we had Tristan on Earl Grey. To me, I think a good spinoff show, Chris, if you need another Trek FM show, and I know you need more, is if Daniel and Tristan could have their own show where Tristan is constantly one-upping the one-upper. I think that would be a great show. Okay. What do you think, Daniel?
Stop it. Stop it, Philip. So what you're saying, let me get this straight. You guys are saying you're proposing a show, basically a Waldorf and Statler show replaced with Neelix and Chakotay is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Why
it's
not?
Perfect. And they watch Star Trek episodes together. And then they say, like, awesome. I don't even know why we watch this every night.
They'll so be it's like, a combination of like Mystery Science Theater and Waldorf and Statler, and they only watch Star Trek episodes. Yes.
You think this episode is bad? Take this Voyager episode. They really screwed that one up, and I have to watch it.
This episode.
For anyone who doesn't recognize the names, you know the guys. Waldorf and Statler are the two old guys on the Muppet Show who sit up and heckle the Muppets throughout the show.
This show isn't half bad. No, it's all bad.
That's right. And then Neelix could be the Swedish chef. Bork, bork, bork.
See, that's actually, he guest stars in Enterprise, where Hoshi has to translate what he's saying because the translator's not working. So.
Could we come up with like a Muppet equivalent for all of the Star Trek characters? Because I think that would be a lot of fun.
I bet we could.
Well, Kermit would clearly be TNG. I mean, that's not even an argument. It is a.
He would be Captain Picard. Yeah.
Well, no. Picard would be Sam the Eagle.
Yeah.
Except he, instead of Kermit's America, it would be France. The blue, red, and white, or whatever the order is.
All right, Internet. Get on
And
this.
The guy who's just always blowing up stuff, that would definitely be a DS9er. Yes. That's like no question at all.
Oh, great. So what I was impressed about in the scene is, I mean, we all know that Ethan Phillips has great comedic timing, but I was impressed with Robert Beltran in here, too.
He does a good grumpy old man.
He does. It was great. It was subtle, but he played off of Ethan Phillips so well.
It was funny because I was watching the episode and he's in his quarters. And I think he orders something from the replicator, I think.
Yeah,
at some point.
Yeah.
And he starts like shaking. And I feel like at that point in my mind, Robert Beltran was preparing to act, you know, because he doesn't do that very often. So he's like,
warming up.
Here comes my scene. But no, but I agree. Like the, you know, the sick bay stuff was great. Like it's really, he's got to kind of get himself warmed up for that. But it was really good. It was really good stuff.
So he's got to get himself warmed up for that, but he has to do it on camera.
Okay, here comes a scene where I've got to do something. Hang on. Okay. Yeah.
Could you go ahead and roll the cameras here? I'm going to warm up for this.
That's better than what I thought, which is I thought, they're going to redo Threshold.
Oh,
yeah. He's just complaining to Neelix and suddenly his tongue falls out? Is that what you're saying?
Right, exactly. Right, yeah, right. He loses his hair, he can't breathe, he's shaking, he can't drink the coffee, and he loses
his tongue. If you go to sick bay, the doctor has this drawer that he pulls out, and it's got like body parts from all the crew members that have fallen out at different times.
And there's like 12 tongues.
See, I feel like with Daniel, he would describe it as like when nobody's looking, the doctor wears it as a necklace, and he just goes off the deep end like Apocalypse Now.
Come on. That's disgusting. I could see him doing that in Da Vinci simulation too.
Wasn't it convenient that they pulled out the Da Vinci simulation here? They got a little bit more mileage out of that by having the doctor go hide there. Of course, the real reason that he went to hide there was so that Robert Picardo could wear tights.
He's been begging to do that.
Apparently so.
For years, he said, yeah.
I thought he just wanted to paint the Italian girls.
I was actually going to mention that. I was going to say that I'm no art critic, but I feel like Robert Picardo was actually a student of, I should say the doctor is a student of Captain Picard because his painting wasn't that great. And as we know from TNG, you know, Data criticizes Captain Picard's painting pretty heavily. So
that's true.
I'm just remembering that scene because you just have great Data. Like he pauses before like giving his review. What am I looking at on here?
Well, Jeri Ryan loved the idea of Bob Picardo in tights so that she was not the only person on the show who had to wear tights that day.
Right.
Okay. This is out of nowhere, but I do have to talk about this. Seven of Nine and her outfit. This is the most, and I mean this in a good way, the most conservative outfit we ever see Seven wear. And I'm like, why wasn't she in this thing the whole time? Nothing's sticking anywhere. There's no silver to accent any parts of her body. It's conservative, thick,
it's
high,
got a high
collar. Yeah, and you know, and this is kind of early, right? It's mid fourth season, right? And so,
well, this is seventh episode, so yeah, she's just kind of getting into the crew.
She's not yelling at anyone. No one's yelling at her. Her and B'Elanna have cool and calm conversation. Nobody's throwing anything.
Kind of.
I'm cool, like, for a Klingon.
I think everyone had maybe the aliens gave everyone a chill pill because this was a very chill character.
Except for Janeway.
Yeah, except for her. But
except
everyone else,
Janeway.
Why can't we all get along on the Voyager crew as we do in this episode?
They definitely gave Tuvok a chill pill. I love his line. Shall I flog them as well?
Best thing in this episode.
And then he even offered to have a glass of wine with her. So he was definitely chill.
He is the confidant for Janeway because I love that he's the only person on the ship who will call her out. And he does it in that calm Vulcan way. But then he also cares as well. And he's sympathetic towards her. And like you said, he said, I will have a glass of wine with you.
Some might call that a job description for a first officer.
No.
You might.
You know, it was funny because the last time that I was on the Ready Room, everybody but Philip here, sorry, Philip, we were doing Message in a Bottle. And that episode kind of starts out with B'Elanna yelling at Seven. And then this episode kind of starts out with the same thing. And I was like, is my Netflix queue stuck on this? Or like, what is going on? But it makes sense because it's early, you know, early in Seven's voyage on the Voyager crew. But
Yeah, those two have a lot of confrontation.
One thing about that conversation at the beginning that besides me saying, oh, look, B'Elanna broke into Seven's clubhouse. One thing that it did that I think is overlooked often is that Seven's addition to the crew, especially early on here, does highlight to us how much B'Elanna has grown because B'Elanna even stops and says, you know, I received that speech one time myself. Yeah. And you really can see how B'Elanna has changed. And it does take someone else who's coming in as that outsider, that person that doesn't want to follow the rules for different reasons, but doesn't want to follow the rules And then you see B'Elanna start trying to help, and B'Elanna gets upset at Seven, not just in this episode, but in other episodes as well. Again, like Message in a Bottle, about the things that she does that B'Elanna probably would have done herself in the past.
Yeah, but Seven isn't rude. She says she's sorry. I mean, oh, it was so conflict-free. I loved it. But then again, I'm TNG-er, right? So that's how we do it.
It's good. I actually really liked it a lot. And this isn't a criticism at all about it, but it was funny because, you know, B'Elanna was like, oh, I went through something similar. And I was thinking in my mind, and I don't take this as a criticism of the episode, but I was thinking in my mind of like, you were a rebellious youth in your culture. Seven was ripped away from her society as a child and removed of all, you know, all sense of self. So I think maybe she's going through a little bit more than what you're used to. But I don't, again, like, I don't consider that a fault of the episode. It was just funny because she was, B'Elanna was like, oh, I know exactly. You know, I went through the same thing when I was on board the ship for the first time. I was like, well, maybe not exactly the same thing, but the sentiment's very nice.
Are you saying Seven should have one-upped her?
She could have. That's all I'm saying is she could have, yeah.
Well, while we're talking about B'Elanna here, let's talk about the B'Elanna-Tom relationship here. And they're really going at it through this whole episode. And at first, before you know what's going on, it just seems like, wow, they're just really, really into each other. And but I have to say, you know, in Star Trek, site-to-site transporting around the ship is something that you just generally don't do. In fact, I believe at one point it was something like, you know, this is really dangerous. We could end up in a wall or something, you know, a long time ago in Star Trek. And then it gets like, okay, well, someone's really injured. We can emergency beam them directly to sick bay. But I don't think Riker even used the transporter to take flowers to women and go make out with ensigns around
Chris, the ship. Chris. Riker. With Riker, the women come to him. He does not.
They all beam to Decade themselves, right?
Yeah.
They've got Decade is pre-programmed on all the transporter panels around the ship.
In fact, we thought that encounter at Farpoint, that when the person asked, you know, where can I find, you know, Commander Riker, and that actually Commander Riker has programmed all the door panels to go to his room. So you'll right. just be, anytime a female, I'll ask, where do I go? And it starts, do-do-do-do-do-do. Like, wait, why am I in front of Will Riker's room?
But it scans. It scans their voice and their biometrics as well to make sure that they're female.
Well,
that's Chris, Wesley uncovered this, though, by disabling the biometric scanning and then just speaking in a high-pitched voice. And he got beamed to Riker's quarters, and then he ran to tell his mom about it.
Now Chris, know, remember, Riker does not stick with one gender, so don't keep him into one gender.
That is true.
Yeah, that's true. He's not limited by that.
It's funny that you mentioned site-to-site transport, and then you mentioned Riker, because I was thinking in Second Chances, there's no way Thomas Riker actually went to all those places on the ship to place those sweet little notes. He definitely just transported them there. He's like, computer, create some awesome, romantic, sweet note puzzle thing that Deanna can find me, and then so he just transported them there. But you know, that's something different.
Now, when he made that request, was it just like the doctor who asked for a tool and it just like falls into the pail in the holodeck and just picked it out?
I was gonna mention that. I loved that the replicator dispenses objects into a metal bucket.
It was
the Da Vinci simulation. That was awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. The site-to-site transport is not even the most moronic thing about that whole intro. It's the mere fact that Tom has to bring the pad to Chakotay, because in the 21st century, we can access and send files anywhere with devices that fit in the palm of our hands.
But sure,
they didn't foresee this, obviously.
Sure. What? We sometimes rag on Voyager for its lack of continuity and attention to detail, but this is continuity throughout Star Trek. All the way back from TOS through TNG, you always have to run things around the ship by pad.
Yeah, I know. It's true. It's just that really kind of hit me at how important this was as a result this time. And yeah, I guess they didn't really start IMing each other via pad until 1998. So yeah, they're a little behind.
My favorite part in the intro was Tom saying he has to go run errands. Okay, excuse me, this is the 24th century. He is a single man. He doesn't have any kids in the nursery. He doesn't have to buy groceries. You know, what errands do you possibly run on a starship?
What do you do?
Dry cleaning? I mean, no.
Philip, he's got to go pay his comm badge bill. Otherwise, how's he going to get in touch with Bellona?
He can't. That's why he had to beam over. He wanted to call her, but he couldn't because he used up all of his comm badge minutes. He had to go pay his bill and recharge. I think actually he's got one of those comm badges where it's pay as you go.
Yeah.
So you have to go recharge.
And the thing is, in the 24th century, because of like the time zones and you're in different quadrants, maybe you're the only ship in the quadrant, you know, the minutes don't roll over. You have to make sure you get it on the first of the month every time.
Yeah, which star date is it? I don't know. What's rollover for a star date? I don't. And does he have Harry Kim on his friends and family plan? That's my question.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Definitely. Without a doubt. Yeah.
Definitely. So about the relationship, I want to talk about the conversation that Tom and Bellona have at the very, very end of the episode and whether we think that's true or not. But as it's going along, though, Char, what were you thinking just in terms of Tom? So the relationship has sort of started and then we get to this episode and now they're going hot and heavy. What were you thinking first time through, not knowing that aliens were screwing around with them? Did it seem like too much? Did it work for you as a story between these two characters?
Well, given the fact that I was 16 when this episode aired, it seemed perfectly normal and perfectly healthy to me.
Now, did you have the headgear at the time?
The relationship, you know, it is hot and heavy, and all you do is make out all the time. When it's new like that, it's that novelty aspect. Yeah, it is hot. It is just all that constantly. But yeah, okay. Several years later. Had I not known what was going on, I would be thinking, okay, how old are you? And how ridiculous is this that you actually had to be disciplined by the captain for making out while on duty? Yeah, we could expect a little better of you. But given the influence, I'm just going to chalk it to that and leave it there.
Roxanne did an amazing job when Tuvok comes in of playing the 16-year-old girl that just got caught by her parents.
She really did. Yeah.
Well, I think one thing that troubled me about the episode was that I really couldn't figure out what their conflict was. I mean, I got it, but I didn't, like, okay, do we want it to be secret or not? But I'm like, who cares? I mean, and I get that they're acting like 16-year-olds, but, like, surprise everyone, we're in a relationship. Everyone would be like, shrug and move on. Like, I don't know who cares that they're, I mean, I get that they're self-conscious, it's a new relationship, and I also kind of got to figure out what they were getting in trouble for. Like, we caught you making out, okay, I mean, is there a Starfleet regulation? I mean, probably when you're rolling
around
the engine
room,
but.
Well, when you're hitting buttons on the console, you're probably sending weird messages to the bridge that is probably bad.
It lights up on the view screen. Oh, Tom.
Suddenly the audio feed goes through the whole ship.
And the Kim's at his station saying, when does it get to say, oh, Kim?
No, and then Tom says, you know, I knew I should have paid my minutes after I went to see Bellona. Right. That way everybody wouldn't have known her business. But no, the last scene, I assume, and my memory may be a little fuzzy or wrong, but they're alluding to the episode where Bellona and Tom are hugging, like in deep space, right?
Right,
like,
gravity hugging. Space, yeah.
In the space.
I don't remember the name of the episode. I'll bow to your expertise, but like they're like, and she's like, I love you, and it's great. Because we don't know, we're never told when this experiment starts, but they actually suggest, presumably in the episode, that hey, maybe that had happened before then,
right?
And they're like. They kind of use that as a flirting point, but do we think that's a possibility? Are we like, maybe this whole thing is a ruse?
I think maybe that's what they kind of want you to ponder, but I actually don't buy that. I think that they genuinely started the relationship on their own accord. And actually, that ending scene, I think, is so incredibly corny where they're using it as kind of a flirtation device, and I can't stand it. But... it's planted there, I think, just to make you wonder, well, where is this going to go exactly? Are they going to call it off or is it going to keep going?
Well, I mean, my only complaint with the ending, instead of it, you know, them, you know, kissing and it just closing. I wish they had used the old soap opera technique of them kissing and then the camera just floats off and it fades to black. And then you're left to wonder. Well, sure, I know watching this episode, you were like, yay, but this is not the couple I wrote about that should be making out.
This is true. When I was 16, I was not writing fan fiction about these two.
I thought, was there a strong blog entry the day after? Like, what? Tom and Bellana, that's not, come on, guys. Why couldn't that increase Trukoki's dopamine levels?
I didn't mind Tom and Bellana at all. I thought it was great that they had like a real relationship happening on the show. But of course, that wouldn't be my initial pairing of choice. No.
So, okay, let me ask you this question, Char.
Yeah.
We have the Tom and Bellana scene at the end. Fade to black. Cut to Janeway's ready room. Chakotay walks in. And Janeway's like, you know, you look so much better with hair.
And he does. He really does.
Well, and then maybe another fade to black or some music. And if they had, maybe to make
that's where the fanfic comes in. Yeah. That there were episode addendums like this.
Is there one where like they have a little headgear for the monkey and that he has? Well, I'll just ask Tristan maybe.
Tristan will have all the monkey details. Yes.
Okay. The monkey would have never put up with this experimentation. Not at all.
No, he would have thrown poop at him.
Well, see, the message then would have been clearer.
Someone tweeted, Char, or maybe it was in an iTunes review, someone actually said that they're concerned that Tristan is maybe a little bit too obsessed with the monkey.
This was an iTunes review. Someone was genuinely concerned that maybe he's going a little too far. She was disturbed by his amount of monkey love.
That's right.
Sorry,
hashtag
Tristan,
monkey
love.
Tweeted it. The Insane Robin on Twitter.
Who is my ex-co-host now.
After hearing this.
I'm sorry. I'll send you Snickers bars.
No.
That's what we do whenever I lose a bet.
Oh, I was actually going to ask if monkeys liked Snicker bars. I didn't know if that was...
Only
no,
banana.
No. Like, occasionally we've made bets on the show, and whenever I lose, I send him candy. Oh. So far, I haven't won.
Now, it sounds like you're doing some kind of experiment on him with, you know, if he does a certain behavior, you'll reward him.
Messing with his blood sugar levels, seeing what happens. Eat another one, Tristan. Eat it.
Well, I think about the relationship here, the conversation they have at the end. Yeah, it is kind of planted there to make you think like, oh, maybe these experiments have been going on for some time and that's the deal. But I felt like that was merely the explanation as to why these two adults who were senior crew members were acting like teenagers throughout this episode, but that the feelings that they have for each other were real and genuine from the very beginning, because they actually developed pretty naturally on the show. You know, this is one relationship that I think Star Trek really got right and didn't feel forced. And it made sense that these two people, if you look at their backgrounds, would come together, but not immediately. It's not like that flash in the pan, love at first sight thing. It's that they get to know each other and they come together. And I think they realized that at the end of the episode, you know, when Tom says, thank God we found out in time, but then they kiss anyway, that they're just, maybe those hormone levels are dropping now that the experiments are over and the real feelings are starting to come back. But I saw it merely as an explanation for the crazy behavior that they had in the over the top, hot and heavy sneaking around the ship that was going on.
Well, and we on Earl Grey had our All Good Things podcast, and there was actually a deleted scene we didn't actually release where we talk about these aliens visiting the Enterprise D, and Troy and Worf, that's why they got together, because the aliens were messing with their hormones. And so not a lot of people know that, but...
That makes sense.
Yes, there has to be some other explanation, because
seriously,
otherwise, why else would I want to vomit every time they're on screen together? I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, one last thing to talk about here before we wrap up. There was a lot of optical candy, you know, visual effects, both makeup and scenes outside the ship, space scenes and such. And this has been pointed out by a number of fans and actors and crew as things they like about this episode. Plus, we get this X-ray vision thing, which we've touched on here and there. And I think we should just talk about one last time, because Brandon Braga said about this that I thought it worked well. It allowed us to see two people kissing with an X-ray machine on, which was pretty creepy. Something that he said in Cine Fantastique way back in the day. I'm just thinking about the idea, like you're sitting around as a writer, you know what'd be really cool and really creepy and maybe a little bit hot is if we could see two people kissing with an X-ray machine on them.
Okay. I'm going to jump in because I've been wanting to talk about this the whole time, and maybe I'm
even before he saw the episode,
and maybe I'm the only one here. Is anyone else here on the podcast familiar with the 1980s science fiction film They Live? John Carpenter's film They Live. Okay,
Is this with Roddy Piper?
Listen, Philip, don't interrupt me. it's a classic. Yeah, I've only seen it once when I was way younger, and then just there are kind of allusions to it all around. Anyways, this guy gets this essentially amazing pair of sunglasses, which allow him to see. He can see that there are aliens, that some of the population has been replaced with aliens. Mm-hmm. And he can see subliminal messages on billboards where it's like, go to this sale. And instead of that, he puts on the sunglasses and it says consume. Or you will see that there are like the bank teller at your local bank is an alien. And this is what I guarantee you. I can promise $1,000. I can't prove it, but I can promise it that that whoever wrote this episode has seen this movie, because as soon as Seven gets that, the doctor's like, oh, I'll just fiddle with your thingy thing, with your eye thing, and then you can see everything. It's basically kind of the same exact effect. And I can't believe that nobody's seen this before. This is kind of blowing my mind.
I don't remember
you guys
that
should
one,
check
no.
it out.
Yeah.
It's, no, Daniel, yeah, it's written I by actually John. Met Roddy Piper 2 weeks ago in Charlotte at a convention. So
did you really?
Yes. So that's why I've never seen the movie, but the person I was with had seen it and they talked about that movie with him.
Seriously. If everybody on the panel here and all of you listening in podcast land, if you're not familiar with the movie, look up the YouTube clip. I'm all out of bubblegum. I'm all out of bubblegum, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's really fantastic.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible for them to have, because it's such a mirror of the same exact effect of like the filter goes down and then all of a sudden you can see that there mm-hmm. are people manipulating things behind the scenes. And it's like I feel like it kind of has had to have happened where they have known that.
In this episode, that style felt a bit like the way Borg vision is usually portrayed though as well, which I found a little bit odd because I wasn't thinking, I guess because the implants Seven can, if they activate her Borg optical implant, then she sees that way again. She doesn't see that way all the time, though, right? She's normally seeing more as a human vision most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
I imagine if Geordi was on the Voyager crew, we wouldn't have had this episode at all, because he would have just been like, what are all these new guys doing here? Yeah. Like, what's going on?
Nobody told me we were picking up all these new crew members. Why aren't they wearing uniforms?
Oh, well, yeah. I think like the kissing part of the X-ray, like it reminds me, like this is what they should show like tweens in health class so they'll never kiss anyone. It's like, this is what it looks like, kids. Oh, I'm never doing that. No. But with the makeup, I really appreciate they did a lot of work and it was really good, except we talked about Neelix and Chakotay, and just let me compare that. The Neelix makeup is awesome, the whole Mylian spots, and you know, they say a Neelix never changes his spots, but in this episode he does. But like the Chakotay old age makeup, like I wish they had said something else, cuz that's not old age. That's I've turned into a hairless mutant makeup. I mean,
right? Threshold.
Yeah.
That's why it made me think of that.
It's like, 8 inches of makeup on top of his skin. I mean, I don't think if Beltran lives to be 200 years old, he will not look like that.
I grew older and my face became really puffy. And
now I'm allergic to peanuts. How'd that happen?
The one cool takeaway we do get to see, though, out of this is that we see the full tattoo for the first time. There is that.
You never want to go full tattoo.
Right. Which was not as exciting as when we got to see the full extent of Dax's spots.
Well, no, of course
nope,
not.
Nope. Nope. Not even close.
Oh, God.
Or even as exciting when we see Q's full tattoo, right? Because his is a lot bigger.
Yes. His not was bigger.
But this had nice visual effects. It will be very interesting to see when Voyager is remastered on Blu-ray, the scenes outside the ship with the binary pulsars, with the alien ships trying to detach themselves. One of them gets destroyed. I'm looking forward to seeing how that looks as well. Certainly, I think that as technology advanced, this was 1997 when this episode aired. As technology advanced on Star Trek, we got better and better and better opticals. And, Voyager here midway through the series was really giving us more and more high quality visuals that really added to the story compared to what we got, say early on in TNG, because that was late 80s and the computers, we really couldn't do those types of visuals so well. And when you try to do that stuff with models and the computer tools that were available at the time, is extraordinarily expensive. So this episode does have a lot of great visuals outside of seeing the inside of Tom and B'Elanna and Chakotay.
Though I think my favorite part about the B'Elanna and Tom moment was when B'Elanna gets the call like, there's a problem with the warp plasma manifold. And she's like, ignore it. It reminded me of like the end of Broken Bow on Enterprise when it's like, Captain, we're detecting an ion storm. Just go through it. Yeah, we'll be fine. I'm like, if Voyager blows up in the next 3 hours, it's because...
We know why.
Although this is worse than on Enterprise because there, Archer is saying, look, we can't be afraid of the wind if we're going to go out here and explore.
It's an ion storm.
And that's like flying your starship through a storm. I mean, it would be like, sailing your ocean ship through a storm here on Earth, whereas this is actually workplace negligence going on right here. It's like, you're the chief engineer. There's something wrong with the engines, but you know what? I'm busy making out right now. Just don't worry about it. It'll be all right. It'll
be fine. Was it really that big of a deal, though? I mean, it couldn't wait until tomorrow. I didn't think it was that important.
But it could have been. You don't know.
Let me offer a defense for B'Elanna's actions there. Maybe she was just like, I'm really sick of Janeway flying into binary stars. Why do I have to pick up for her? She should go down to engineering and clean this stuff up herself.
That's right.
That works for me.
I like that.
Hey, there was an early
lesson.
Teach you
to fly into double pulsars.
There was an early lesson I learned from Janeway. Sometimes you got to just punch it. And that's what she did.
Apparently, she learned that lesson from Captain Pike.
That's right.
Too soon, Chris.
Let's punch it.
Beep. Beep.
Oh, my.
Now, that's her scouring the record. You know how she's the president of the James T. Kirk fan club? She likes to just read through all his old logs. She does the same thing for Pike. All right. That's why she's always quoting Kirk all the time. All right. Well, let's wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings on the episode. So, Philip, what are your final thoughts and rating?
I don't know if I have anything to add because I think I've said it all, but I'll just repeat myself briefly. I think this is a great episode and a very enjoyable episode of Voyager. And I think it ranks up there with a lot of the Message in a Bottle and all of the funny ones. Like I said, even though this is a deadly episode, I think it's hilarious. I think everyone is on their A game. I love all the relationships, whether it's B'Elanna and Doctor working together, Seven and B'Elanna working together, B'Elanna and Tom working together. Everything just flows. And I think this is a must for any Trek watcher and a must for any Voyager watcher. And again, I love that ending with Janeway, you know, because that's, to me, that's vintage Janeway. And I say that in a good way. I know we had some critiques. But as far as my rating, I give it 8 Italian art models out of 10.
Excellent. How about you, Daniel?
I have to say I'm really surprised. I don't know if this is representative of the larger Trek fandom or not, but I'm not as impressed with this episode as you guys are. To me, it's kind of standard fare. It's kind of mediocre. We pull a lot of, it seems, classic influences in science fiction and even Star Trek itself. And it's just like there, it does some interesting things. I really like I mentioned, I like the Chakotay Neelix, which is like a really weird combination that I would never think I would say that I like those two things together. But, you know, that scene was great. And I like Tom and B'Elanna most of the time. They're cool. And I actually like the meaning of the episode, where it's trying to get to. As far as the execution goes, I was just like, meh, okay. I see what you're doing there. And then the ending where Janeway is just like, let's fly the ship into the sun. And I'm just like, I'm not on board with you yet. I don't know how to do that with you. But so I think it's probably middle of the road Voyager, middle of the road Star Trek. For me, it's probably an even like a 5 isolinear chips. And I have to say that because I can't believe they had isolinear chips in this episode, because I thought all of their isolinear chips were replaced with the biomed gel packs. But there's a part in the scene in the episode where 7 is moving isolinear chips around, and so I give it 5 isolinear chips.
That's a classic Star Trek thing you have to do. You know, when there's a real problem, you just have to move around isolinear chips, and sometimes you don't even have to finish. Like in the episode Civil Defense on Deep Space Nine, Sisko is changing the isolinear rods to redirect the energy out to the shields so the station won't blow up. And when the discharge goes off, he's still got 2 of them in his hands. So he didn't even finish. and it worked. So.
Okay, I have to say that Voyager impresses me that Tuvok is only the best trained security officer in all of the fleet. Because this is the only episode of Star Trek ever when somebody tries to do something and Tuvok's like, I'm sorry, you're breaking security. What's going on? Any other episode, that shuttlecraft would have been out of the door. The person would have been beamed down. It would have been, you know, we would have gotten the unauthorized notification like 5 days later. But Tuvok is on top of it the second 7 tries to do anything. So Tuvok.
It's that chill pill.
Yeah.
I think he was watching her very, very closely because she had been a Borg and she's only been on the ship now for 7 episodes. So he's got like a rule set up in the system to alert him anytime 7 does anything.
He set up his 7 push notifications.
Right.
Daniel,
I actually think that your view of the episode is possibly closer to general fandom, because this episode typically does receive ratings of around 5 out of 10 when it's rated by different publications and such. So you may be the closest to reality of all of us here tonight.
Oh, yes.
But you still have to find a new podcast now, so sorry.
No!
So, Char, what about you?
Well, I think I liked it a little more than the general consensus, apparently. I think it's pretty solid. Objectively, I would say it's probably, you know, maybe like a 7 out of 10. I think it's a solid story. Its execution, it has its problems, but it's not awful. And the message is what really does it for me, though. And the way this this episode had a personal impact on me makes it a nostalgic favorite and very important to me personally. In that respect, it gets 9 flogs out of 10. But, objectively... I think it's just a pretty decent hour of Trek. I think it's entertaining. It's got a good message. Not bad at all. I think it's better than mediocre. 7 flogs out of 10.
Well, I like this episode. I judge it more against other Voyager episodes. There are definitely things that have been done before and that you've seen before. What this episode does for me that disappoints me often about Voyager episodes is that I feel like they did get the pacing right in this episode, and they did pull you in and make you wonder what's going on, and it has very interesting character interactions as well. And then it has a good message at the end, and it doesn't try to tell you what you're supposed to think at the end either. It gives you both sides and then leaves you with that. And so I think it's a very good Voyager episode all in all. And so I'm going to give it 8 horny crew members.
Nice.
You know, I try to behave because I feel like there's a standard. And then Chris comes with his grade. And I'm like, well, if I had known.
Sorry, it's not. I'm just not myself. I think some aliens are, you know, screwing around with me here. And that's why I'm saying things like that tonight.
Is that why you're wearing headgear?
That's right. And it says Bose on the side, which gives me a clue of which aliens we should try to track down. Those Boseans, man, they're always screwing around with you.
Bose? That sounds Swedish.
It does. All right. So before we go, Daniel and Philip, thanks for joining us today. Tell everyone, we've mentioned the name of your show, Earl Grey, many times tonight. Tell everybody about Earl Grey and where they can find you elsewhere on the network and around the interwebs. Who's the spokesperson for Earl Grey here between the two of you?
Well, don't make
apparently Captain America over there. So
that's right. That's right, Lieutenant Belgium. Yes, they can hear all the great and wonderful things and even the not so great and wonderful things about Star Trek The Next Generation on Earl Grey, our wonderful podcast we have with myself, Daniel, and Darren Moser, a.k.a. Dr. Sci-Fi of Dr. Sci-Fi fame. And they can listen to us each and every week where we talk about all things TNG. And they can find me on Twitter. My handle is NC Public Servant, where I talk about all kinds of things, political jokes that Daniel does not get, or Star Trek and Doctor Who references. He'll get half the Doctor Who references because he doesn't know any Doctor Who past 1994. And so you can find us there.
Excellent. Where can people find you, Daniel, if they want to hit you up, try to one-up you?
They can try, including Tristan, by the way, who was mentioned earlier as one-upping me all the time, at one-up Dan. That is the number one, not the word. And by the way, you can also, on top of the Trek FM handle, you can send all of your Trek Muppet combinations to me, because I'm actually really fascinating with this concept, and I kind of want to build a profile of what each character would be as a Muppet. So,
could you make a Photoshop deal out of this?
That would be great.
I want to see it.
Maybe we can make t-shirts out of it. That's what we need, some Trek FM merchandise.
Yeah.
Would you be doing Muppet Star Trek Danfic?
Well, look, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but maybe down the road, that's a possibility for sure.
I'm going to go check MuppetFanfic.com and see if that exists yet.
Run by Daniel Crew.
Hold on. Wait till the end of the podcast. Who knows what's going to end up playing?
Gosh. Miss Piggy and Beaker. Wow. I never expected that.
There's a lot of squealing. No, nobody knows what's saying what.
In space, no one can hear you squeal.
Hi, Dad. I'm not gonna do it.
Hermit Animal Slash Fic. I gotta read this.
And of course, it would be pigs in space, so it'd be Trek related.
That would be. Oh God.
Oh goodness. All right. Thanks again for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chris, it's always fun talking with our guys from Earl Grey, Philip and Daniel. And as much as I love Tristan, it is good every now and then to talk some TNG references and see the Voyager from a slightly different point of view.
Yeah, how did you feel being in a group of people for whom Voyager is not their favorite series?
I'm used to it. No big deal.
No, but this was a good episode. I really enjoyed the discussion, and I'm glad we had the TNG guys on because, you know, I had not even thought about Lonely Among Us, but yeah, I can see that.
I hadn't either. I had only made the schisms parallel.
Yeah.
So that was a very good point to make out. And I think we hit this one from a lot of angles. There's a lot going on, actually. And I think we did a nice job of covering all the bases this week.
Right. A much better job of covering all the bases than Tom and B'Elanna did, because otherwise half the crew wouldn't be gossiping about them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Some things are just best left in your quarters. Okay, guys. That is all.
All right. Well, yeah, it was great talking about scientific method today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network over the past week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Where no man has gone before, comic versus episode.
They talk about how we just picked up this psychiatrist from Alderaan.
Alderaan. This is called Alderaan.
Earl Grey.
All good things.
In a universe where Troy is dead, the Enterprise D lives on. That's all I want to say. It's the only thing that matters.
The Ready Room.
Simple defense.
Dukat recorded messages, obviously, for a lot of different scenarios. Isn't it funny to think of him, like, you know, whatever, 10 years before this episode, like, yeah, you know, putting a day aside. It's like, I have to sit in front of a camera and just think of ways they could screw us.
The Orb.
Till death do us part.
His are very quizzical in nature. They're of the scientist. They're of the somebody who is willing to accept, okay, what is this reality? What's going on? She's just all like, tell me what to do right now. You know, like,
right.
There's nothing spiritual about her.
To the journey!
Voyager Season 4 Marathon.
I was working full-time on top of being a full-time student, and I...
Listen, I don't want to hear your excuses, okay? I don't want to hear them.
Like, life was happening, and...
A great man once told me, if something's important to you, you make the time. Warp 5.
Organians on Enterprise.
Part of what this episode of Enterprise is about for me is it's the search for the Organian society to find compassion again.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Griff Bull and the X-Files, Bad Blood.
It's actually kind of odd because the audience can piece together the narrative flow better than, you know, their boss.
That's because their boss didn't have the brilliant direction of Cliff Bull to observe.
Literary Treks.
Greg Cox, No Time Like the Past.
The one thing I had to be very careful of, and this was another sort of potential minefield that I had to navigate, was nobody in Kirk's time knows who the Borg are. So she can't, like, oh, hi, I'm 7 of 9. I'm a former Borg. You know, they don't know the Borg. She has to be careful not to tell them the Borg.
And introducing Continuing Mission, our newest show all about fan series and independent productions.
Star Trek continues with Doug Drexler.
Everybody who does a Star Trek show in CG, the first thing they do is make the ship 947 feet long. Well, there's no way it's going to look the same, because the ship that they shot on television wasn't 2,000 feet long. It was 11 feet long.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So there's your co-host Tristan right there, Shar, giving us the rundown of the shows. I'm surprised he didn't throw in also on the monkey, or you know how he is with that monkey, but anyway.
He's waiting to start up yet another podcast, monkey.fm.
Oh, God.
It's going to be all things monkey hosted by Tristan every week.
Oh, man. This Week in Monkeys. Well, that'll be something.
This Week in Monkeys.
Anyway, enough with the monkeys.
You can see him doing it, right? Right?
I actually could see him doing it. That's the scary part.
Yeah.
Anyway, everyone, go check out these shows. You can find them in a variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. So go grab these shows, find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe, and stay tuned for that monkey talk coming somewhere down the road. All right, Shar, we got an iTunes review actually yesterday, just right before we put together the show notes here. And this is from listener Dante Hopkins. And Dante left us a wonderful review in the US iTunes store, gave us 5 stars, said a regular chat about Trek. And what else did he have to say about the show, Shar?
Well, I think this is very flattering. Dante said that the podcast is like sitting with a group of friends who like Star Trek as much as you do. And of course, we do what we do every week here and talk about an episode of a particular series. So the fact that he thinks that sounds like a bunch of friends just chatting and getting together, but doing a good job at it, if I may add that, every week. That's great praise. And definitely. So for him, it sounds like he doesn't have a big group of Trek friends in real life. So this is a great way for him to connect with like-minded people. And he looks forward to the news and topics every single week. And he praises you, Chris, for doing such a great job of making every episode engaging and an all-around fun discussion. He says, great work.
Well, thank you. And he also praises all of you guys as well. He says that it is a great way to hear what Chris and his great roster of guests and co-hosts from all over Trek FM feel about episodes of Star Trek. So for everyone, and Dante, thanks so much for the great review. And especially, I'm glad that we feel like a group of friends for you and that you're enjoying the chats, because that's what we are. We are a group of friends. We just happen to get together.
It's true. We really are friends. Yes, you can't fake that.
And we just happen to get together online, turn on our web cameras, and record ourselves every week talking about the episodes. And I'm glad you enjoyed it. And for everyone else, if you enjoy the show as well, you know, drop by and let us know what you think. Drop by iTunes and leave us a star rating and a written review. That really does help other listeners find the show as they search iTunes for Star Trek podcasts. And it only takes a moment, and we love to hear from you. And if you'd like to send us feedback in other ways, you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come to us by email. You can also go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners. You can send us a voicemail through the website, or in social media, you can go to facebook.com/trekfm, or you can go to Twitter and look us up under username trekfm. Also, if you have questions about Star Trek that you would like for us to discuss during the news segment, we would love to do that as well. If you go to that same contact form at trek.fm/contact and choose messages from the fleet, send us your questions about Star Trek. It can be something that you've always wondered about that you'd like us to find out for you, or it could be something where you want to know our thoughts on a particular topic, and we'll talk about that during news. So again, that's trek.fm/contact, and choose questions from the fleet. Now, Char, when you're not, you know, trying to figure out how to get rid of that splitting headache that you've had all day and screaming at your coworkers for making out in the break room, where can people find you?
Well, normally you can find me hanging out on Twitter, talking a myriad of things, whether it's Fargo weather or Star Trek. My handle is Oh the Profanity.
And if you want to hear Char live up to her handle, because she has to kind of, you know, we like to keep it family friendly here on Trek FM. You need to go and listen to another show that's done by our friend Jenny Zell, who some of you know as a guest on the show here sometimes, called Mouthy Broadcast. Char's on there from time to time as well. And then you'll find out why her handle is Oh the Profanity.
Right. That is the real me. This is the performance. That's right. And of course, you can also find me with Tristan Riddell, our wonderful monkey expert on To the Journey.
To the
New
Journey.
New episodes drop every Thursday. Thank you. New episodes every Thursday. Check us out. We talk anything and everything related to Voyager. So if you enjoyed this episode, give us a listen.
Absolutely. It's a really fun show. Actually, that is the thing that people say when they review To the Journey consistently is how much fun they have listening to you and Tristan and how much fun the show is.
Well, and that's awesome to hear, because I'm glad they're having fun, but so are we. We really do enjoy doing the show. We have fun. It is fun. I love that.
It's always fun to talk about Star Trek, but you can't fake fun, and it really comes through on To the Journey. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me as well. I'm in a lot of places around the network. I do two shows with Matthew Rushing. We do Literary Treks together, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics, and we interview authors. For Voyager fans, 2 weeks ago, actually now, it's not the current episode of Literary Treks, but the one before, we had Greg Cox, the wonderful author, on the show to talk about his new original series novel, but it's actually a crossover where Seven of Nine goes back in time and ends up with Kirk and his crew, which I know sounds crazy, but trust me, It's a really good story. And Greg joined us on the show to talk about that. The name of the book is No Time Like the Past. I highly recommend that you pick it up and read it, and then go over and listen to that episode of Literary Treks. It's episode 54. And find out from Greg, you know, how that concept of bringing 7 of 9 back and merging the Voyager and the TOS flavors together came about.
I'm glad you mentioned that it sounds crazy, because it really does. It does. So you just got to read it and judge for yourself.
That's right.
Yeah.
Besides Literary Treks, Matthew and I do The Orb together every week, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. I also do Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And then I have my interview show, Matterstream, which is largely about science and social issues and creative, that's inspired by Star Trek or loosely related to Star Trek. And then I have a new show called Continuing Mission, which is all about Star Trek fan series and independent productions. And we've talked about Star Trek Continues on there with Doug Drexler, talked about Star Trek Axanar with Alec Peters as well. And we've got some other really exciting stuff coming up, including some stuff that'll be of great interest to Voyager fans. So stay tuned for that. And you can find all these shows, again, as we mentioned, in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, all the different places. So go check those out if you're interested. And then as far as finding me personally, look me up on Twitter. That's the easiest way. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. So give me a follow. Say hello. I'd love to chat Star Trek with you or anything else. And talk to you over there. Also, Char, before we let everyone go, I'd like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show one more time, and that's Audible.com. They have over 150,000 titles for you to choose from, so no shortage of fantastic books for you to enjoy on your commutes, when you're exercising, wherever it is. And as I mentioned in news today, you can pick up Shatner Rules, Your Key to Understanding the Shatnerverse and the World at Large, absolutely free, just for trying Audible. And the way you do that is to go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up and choose that or any book you want, and you'll be able to download that absolutely free. If at the end of your trial period you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose, because you get to keep that audiobook. But by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week and all of our other shows. So we really appreciate your support there. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we also thank Audible for their support of the Ready Room and the network. One more thing you can do if you'd like to help us keep our shows coming is to make a donation to the network. If you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find different contribution levels to choose from. And we also have original alien illustrations available as buttons or art prints as a thank you for your contribution. Your donations help us pay for the cost of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring not only the Ready Room, but all 15 of our other podcasts to you every week. Again, that's trek.fm/donate, and we really thank you for helping us keep the network going. All right, Char, well, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to pull the curtain here because I'm about to put on my tights. I'm heading back down to the Da Vinci simulation to paint some models with the Doctor.
Oh, well, far be it for me to stop you from doing that, buddy. You go on, you have fun in your tights. I think it's time to stick a head full of needles in it, because this Ready Room is done.